three, students of arcane knowledge like Michael's own mother Muriel, guessed that as the Chili appeared to be a relic of the very earliest epochs of the universe, a time when space-time itself had been a twisted, unhealed thing, that the Chili might head for the nearest major space-time flaw, the axle of the galaxy itself, the supermassive black hole at the very centre, where, perhaps, it was going to build some tremendous artefact, suspected Michael Poole, student of the amulet. So it was theorised. Nobody knew. All that was known about the invading Chili itself had been gathered from a few exploratory expeditions to the locations it had haunted in the solar system, and an inspection of its artefacts, such as the cache, a weapons factory the size of a small moon.
All of which tells us about as much about the nature of the Chili as the study of an exit wound in a corpse would tell you about the nature of the gun that fired the bullet,
Highsmith Marston had once said. Jophiel did know that it was at least possible in principle to hurt a Chili. It was believed that Highsmith Marston's most successful development, based on a weaponized magnetic monopoles, had indeed harmed the Chili in the solar system before it had fled, and perhaps that was why it had fled. And Jophiel knew, too, that it was at least theoretically possible for humans to track the Chili to its lair at the core and beat it, because, in a vanished future, humans had achieved precisely that. The so-called Exultants, though, had evidently fought their war over millennia, and had had the resources of a human galaxy behind them. Michael Poole would have only a handful of ships, a handful of people, just that, and knowledge, whatever could be learned about the Chili and the wider universe of which the species was a part. And that was why the gear had been designed as it was, as a platform dedicated to gathering and assimilating data, as the flotilla crossed spaces never before visited by humankind. On the Cauchy and the island, people were preparing to fight a war. On their gear, their colleagues were learning how to fight. That, at least, was the plan. The trouble was, the gear was drifting off mission. When he materialized inside the gear, Jophiel found himself facing Flammarion Grant. Facing her, and standing alongside a sleeper bank. Pods like coffins, 20 of them, of a white ceramic-like material, each vaguely moulded to the shape of the inert human body it contained, stacked up in an arrangement that had always reminded Jophiel, or his template, of the catacombs beneath ancient Rome. These caskets contained the bodies not of the dead, but of the sleeping human crew, templates for the virtuals of Gear's active crew, including Flammarion, Vinebaum's sister, and Vinebaum himself. Flammarion, stepdaughter of Jack Grant, champion of native life forms on Mars, had been 22 years old when the Gear and the rest of the fleet had left Cold Earth. So physically she was in her late 20s now. An officer where Vinebaum was crew, she wore a black jumpsuit with silver piping, a design based on the standard garb of the stewards, the small group of powerful and generally benevolent individuals who, under Harry Poole, had governed humanity through the crisis of Cold Earth. On the Cauchy and island, the design had been vetoed by Ward in favour of the more practical and highly visible scarlet and blue. But, Jophiel reflected, on a ship full of virtual people, such colour coding was not necessary. In this virtual form, Flammarion was ageless, but in fact, with her delicate features and brushed back blonde hair, she might have been much older, Jophiel thought, though he wasn't sure what instinct was giving him that impression. Was she too perfect? That simulated face too symmetrical to be truly convincing. and he thought there was a vividness about her representation, almost as if her outline were marked by a solid line, as if she were more real than the physical background, more dense with information. Mr. Poole?
Michael?
Oh, I'm sorry. Daydreaming. Perhaps I'm a little disconcerted by the transition. She held out a hand which he grasped, virtual flesh against virtual flesh, utterly convincing.
It's always good to see you again, Michael. I often think of your visit to Chiron after the displacement. Life was somewhat simpler for me then.
And for us all. He released her hand. But call me Jophiel. She frowned at that.
If you wish.
It goes against protocol, I know. The process of my projection was, flawed.
If you like, we could reprogram
and fix me. No thanks. I'm confident I can do the job I, my original, tasked me with, which is to explore the situation here. And thinking of that, he tried to touch the carapace of a sleep coffin close to hand. Unlike the quasi-reality of his contact with Flammarion, his fingers crumbled to pixels with a sharp pain. Flammarion frowned.
Why did you do that? You gave yourself unnecessary discomfort.
Just checking to see what's real and what's not. She considered that. With that simple gesture, he'd meant to send her a signal that he was here for a serious purpose, to ask tough questions, and that seemed to have got through. In response, she began to deliver what seemed to him a pre-rehearsed formal report, or anyhow a summary.
I brought you here first, to the sleeper bank, as I imagined the status of the flesh and blood crew would be your priority. There are 20 of us, as you know, including myself, or rather my template. The virtuals we project of officers and crew are by design limited in duration to 40 ship days. At any moment, only a few human crew, 3 or 4, are awake enough to project new virtuals. Replacements, scienced, refreshed, and motivated to replace the old.
Only 3 or 4 at a time.
That is all that is necessary. Individual crew will throw off more than one virtual if a particular aptitude or function is desired. Or sometimes we will call up copies from backup store.
Multiple copies of individuals, then?
It's not a problem. We don't use variant names, as you evidently have, but we have coding systems of other kinds. Of the Cadre Flammarion grant, my registration is...
He held up a hand. I'm sure it's all very logical.
And by having only a few physical humans moving at any one time, we can minimize the momentum jolt suffered by the ship as a whole.
Which is
also why you banned physical transfers between the ships.
He knew the theory. He had designed it, but still the practical realization of it was startling. We're on a 1,000-ton starship sailing at close to the speed of light. And one human taking a jog around the life dome perimeter can really disturb the stability you require.
It's not just the processing suites. We are an instrument platform, too. We seek evanescent traces, Jophiel. Dark matter and neutrinos. The subtle infrastructure of the cosmos. Imagine a neutrino which could pass unhindered through a light year of lead, being perturbed by a clump of dark matter, which itself interacts with normal matter only through gravity, and we must track that deflection. We're trying to map the dark matter, for example. Its distribution around the galaxy. It makes up most of the galaxy's bulk by mass, but is entirely invisible to human eyes. A thin sheet of it lies within the plane of the galaxy itself, the spiral arms. That much is well known, But now, beyond, in the halo, we are observing huge, tangled towers.
Towers? Structures of some kind? She smiled at him.
Indeed. Not unlike tendrils in some places, reaching down into this puddle we call the galaxy. The dark matter constitutes the bulk of the universe's matter. Why shouldn't it contain structure? And I know what your next question will be.
Life?
Some of us think so. If it exists, dark matter life is vast, slow-moving, hard for us to recognize. But again, why not? Why should life only persist in this thin scum of bright matter we inhabit? That's not all, however. We do have something else still more exciting to report, she said now. From the galactic plane, in this case, lying ahead of us, we've held it back until we have sufficient confirmation. Before you go, I'd like to give you a preliminary report. Before you go? Jophiel felt faintly confused. She did seem genuinely interested in these findings, whatever they were. She had been a scientist, after all. And yet he sensed an odd impatience about Flammarion. He was Michael Poole, or anyhow his representative. He was one of her seniors, the authority on the mission to which she had dedicated her life. What could be more important for her than his presence here now? What agenda did she have? He could imagine what Michael's father, Harry, a far more astute politician than Michael had ever been, would advise now. Time to go fish, son.
So, he said, why not show me around?
Stiff, yet smiling, she bowed slightly and waved her hand. After you. After intense development, before the convoy had left Cold Earth, and 6 ship years of enhancement since, the instruments and artificial sentience processor banks contained within the gear's lifed dome had grown enormously complex in detail. Still, the essential layout was simple enough, Jophiel thought. The life dome itself, save for a perimeter fringe where the sleeper banks, dormitories, medical bays, a refectory and other wet crew facilities were clustered, was not partitioned like the couches. Instead, the whole hemispherical space was dominated by a single monstrous processing tower, a crystalline semi-transparent monolith that reached almost up to the life dome roof. It looked more geological than anything human-made. Peering into this stack, Jophiel glimpsed motion, sparks of light gathered in lines and arcs and more irregular constellations, and sheets of evanescent illumination, there and gone. Jophiel knew enough about sentience engineering to know that all he saw was a surface shimmer, a hint of deep swirls of processing and cognition, echoes of the thought of a huge mind. No, he thought, a community of minds, all artificial. Meanwhile, packing out the spaces around the processor tower, he saw still more complex installations. Boxes and cylinders, enigmatic crystalline structures, even in one place a kind of webbing done out in a somber purple. These were the ship's instruments, its eyes on the universe, he supposed. Some were positioned near breaches in the hull. Others, which evidently needed no direct look outside, huddled under hull plate. Neutrinos and gravity waves, for example, would wash through this structure with impunity, their ghostly passage tracked, recorded, and analysed. He knew that while this was the most significant concentration of such instruments in the flotilla, there were other centres. Matching instruments on Island and Couchy would give a longer baseline to some of the measurements. And he saw virtual crew attending these instruments. They wore what looked like simplified copies of Flammarion's black uniform, done in pale grey with silver flashes. They nodded politely to Jophiel as he passed. There were no embodied humans to be seen, no wet crew in the jargon. The only physically authentic motion came from a couple of bots, small wheeled affairs that rolled with a blameless smoothness across the floor, en route to some task or other. Flammarion was watching him, as if trying to anticipate his thinking.
"You understand why we use virtual humans here, as opposed to fully artificial sapients. I'm sure you're aware of the history of artificial intelligence."
He smiled. The pools were always concerned with big projects, stringing wormholes between the planets. Not so much the fiddly stuff about sentience that nobody seemed to understand. Cognition, consciousness.
"You see, it is much harder to build a mind piece by piece, though that was achieved too. One early example of an entirely synthetic mind was Gia, for whom this ship was named."
"I named it for her. Knew her, or my template did."
"Whereas the creation of human replicants is easy and powerful. The first successful artificial intelligences were in fact emulations of humans, downloads from human nervous systems into other substrates. One can copy even that which one does not fully understand. Thus, replicant virtuals like myself."
"Me too. And yes, we are cheap, relatively."
"Indeed. Though not free in terms of processing capacity. And so here we have these instruments, smart in themselves, supervised by our most effective and efficient artificial intelligences, human copies."
"You know, I commissioned these processor suites. The instruments."
"Or your template did,"
she corrected him mildly. "But I'm having trouble recognizing a lot of what I can see here. Maybe I should have come over here more often. You've clearly gone through a lot of upgrades. To do so much in such little time, it's not 7 subjective years since we left Cold Earth." She seemed to hesitate, then an apparent admission.
"Our restriction in time is not as severe as for our templates."
It seemed an oddly circumlocutory way to refer to the fact that a virtual's inner clock did not have to run at the same speed as a human's, as wet crew. As if she had felt impelled to acknowledge his comment, but in an obscure way as possible. He wasn't sure how to respond, so he didn't say anything at all. "Keep fishing, son." They walked on and met Flammarion's brother.
"Weinbaum, you follow me around?"
Weinbaum seemed briefly baffled. Then he said, "Sink." His expression cleared. "Ah, forgive me. My cadre has not yet been updated with the report of our representative who attended the crew review. Mr. Poole, call me Jophiel. You met a separate projection of Weinbaum Grant, a different partial. It's good to see you again, sir." Jophiel grinned. Whatever "again" means in these circumstances. "Your cadre, though, how many is that?" Flammarion cut across him to Jophiel's surprise.
"I am rather busy, Jophiel. Would it be impolite to leave you in Weinbaum's hands? He is perfectly capable. I can come back in the future if there are further officer-level queries to handle, and to give you that briefing on our discovery."
"In the future, not later." Another odd expression. "That's not a problem. I'll call you if..."
"Thank you."
With a quick smile, she dissolved into pixels, which themselves faded from sight. Weinbaum seemed faintly embarrassed. "I'm sorry about that, sir."
"Call me Jophiel, for Leith's sake.
Where exactly has she gone?" "Officer country. Flammarion always was smarter than me. But, Jophiel, you know that.
So she's the officer and I'm the crew. She did seem impatient to get back there. Weinbaum shrugged. That's officers for you. A minute is a day. Like Flammarion's remark about the future, that comment, casually made, struck Jophiel as peculiar. Weinbaum asked now, what would you like to see next? Jophiel thought that over. He was formulating a theory about what was going on here, suspicions slowly congealing. He had to start somewhere. Show me something I can understand. How about the processor cooling system? Weinbaum grinned and led the way. They passed more crew, all dressed in their grey uniforms, all engaged on routine-looking tasks, many of them involving the supervision of bots who performed any physical work necessary. Jophiel was greeted politely everywhere, but then he wore Michael Poole's face, the most familiar on the mission. And Jophiel started to see patterns. Plenty of virtuals around, but few different faces. Both male and female, a handful of faces shared by many copies. It seemed that a few cadres, in Weinbaum's word, dominated the population. It reminded Jophiel of hints in the pool archives of coalescences, human hives, where everybody was your sister. They even ran into a couple more Weinbaums. Weinbaum himself looked sheepishly proud as Jophiel pointed this out. Well, we Weinbaums are number 3, out of 20 cadres, you see. My sister says there's a kind of natural selection going on. You don't copy all the wet crew evenly. You tend to choose those with specific skills and so on, or those that withstand copying and sciencing better. It seems to trouble some people. Tell me about it, Jophiel muttered. Now they passed through a covered gallery, the light subdued, filled with statues. Well, that was how it seemed at first to a shocked Jophiel. People fully dressed, their skin tones normal, most sitting in lightweight chairs. One couple, two men, held hands. They looked utterly realistic, save for a certain drabness, as if they weren't lit properly. And save for the fact that they appeared quite motionless. Not statues, I'm guessing, he said to Weinbaum. No, sir. This is the reserve. You don't know about that? Tell me. These are virtuals, as I am, but running on a slower clock speed. If you stand here long enough, you can see them shifting, subtly. There's a copy of me in here somewhere, taken after we dealt with the implosion of... Never mind. When a copy's time is done, we don't always science it back, not at once. It may have developed some particular skill or acquired some experience that could be valuable later. Such as... after dealing with some particular breakdown. That's it. If it happens again, we can pull it out of the reserve and put it to work straight away. No need to learn the procedure over again or to dig it out of some memory science long ago. There's still a limit. A virtual can only last 40 days, either subjectively experienced or objectively measured, whichever is longer. Jophiel figured that out. So, if I slowed you down... What felt to you like 40 days might be stretched out, from my point of view, for months, years? That's the idea. Long-term storage. But it's all costing processing power. Look, if you scienced with a copy that showed up on the couchy, you know that I'm here because of anomalous power usages aboard gear. That and a paucity of proper science reports recently. If you have all these spare people just sitting around, literally. But these are running on slow time, Weinbaum said, as if it was obvious. If you are in the reserve, you're running so slowly that what you experience in 1 second is stretched out to half an hour for outsiders. I get it. And the processing costs are that much lower. What's the expansion factor? 1 in 1,000? More like 1500, I think.
1500.
And suddenly, Jophiel saw it. If you could run virtual crew 1500 times slower than normal, then you could run officers 1500 times faster, too. How long was 1500 minutes? 25 hours? Weinbaum had said, a minute is a day. So it was for her. He could even see the logic of speeding up, from a virtual's point of view. If a given copy had to shut down after 40 days of ship time, you could expand that to 40 times 1500, somewhere over 150 subjective years. No wonder Flammarion had been in such a hurry to get away. Every second she spent out here, every heartbeat spent dealing with Sloeth Sloth's normal humans, was a waste of her life, literally. But of course, if a copy running 1500 times slower cost that much less than a regular projection, a copy running 1500 times faster would cost that much more, as much as running 1500 regular crew in normal time. And that, presumably, was how the power budget was being blown. They walked on. At the heart of the Life Dome, the area of floor at the geometric centre, beneath the great citadel of processing towers, the cooling system was a vast forest of piping underfoot and great ducts overhead. Beyond the translucent walls of the Life Dome, meanwhile, Jophiel glimpsed huge radiator fins, there to dump waste heat into space. They looked as if they were glowing, a measure of the sheer energy flow that passed through this complex, from the gut engine source through the processor stacks and then to the endless heat sink of the vacuum. He could actually hear the roar of heated air flowing through the throats of tremendous ducts. Jophiel knew that the dumping of heat had been a key aspect of information processing design right back to the first electronic computers in the 19th century, or had it been the 20th. But none of this complex had been his, Poole's design, or rather his work was only a vestige of what this had become. And all of this, he saw now, was required to deal with the heat generated by a super-fast simulated environment that had nothing to do with the flotilla's mission. "I've seen enough." Weinbaum looked alarmed. "Sir?" Jophiel dug out his amulet and held it before his face. "Nicola, can you hear me?"
"No."
"Don't ask questions to which there is only one logical answer. What do you want?" "I need you to get me into officer country. I think it's some kind of high-capacity virtual domain. I don't think I should be held back asking for permission."
"Consider it done."
The world began to dissolve. Through a mist of pixels, Jophiel saw Weinbaum reach out towards him.
"Sir, Jophiel, don't!"
He smiled at Weinbaum and closed his eyes. Chapter 5. Darkness. Warmth. He tried to be analytical. He was still standing, he felt, with a kind of jolt, as if his sensorium had been dropped from a height back into his body. The warmth on his face was like sunshine, like before the displacement, when Earth had still huddled close to its sun. He opened his eyes. Green grass, blue sky, people walking, talking too far away to make out or hear. Sunshine. He was in a park. Jophiel could see the shoulders of tall, ancient skyscrapers at the rim of the park, interlaced by flitters darting through the air. Not far away, shielded by trees, he made out a carbon sequestration dome, a sphere of dry ice 400 metres tall, 50 million tons of carbon dioxide boldly frozen out of the atmosphere and lagged, he knew, by a 2-metre layer of rock wool. Long after any practical purpose had gone, Such objects remained as a monument to the early efforts of the recovery generations. Generations, he reflected, that had saved a world. A world that Michael Poole had later thrown out into the dark and the cold in order to save it a second time. Jophiel knew this place. Poole Industries had kept offices here, as in all Earth's great cities. He had come here as a boy with his father. He even recognized the ancient flood marks on the buildings left there as monuments to hard times. This was New York. He raised his face to the sun and breathed deeply. A smell of cherry blossom and freshly cut grass. The sky was laced by high, fluffy clouds, and beyond he saw crawling points of light, the habitats and factories of near-Earth space. But the light was blocked by a shadowed mass to his right. He turned to see a tree, an oak, he thought, judging by its heavy summer leaves. Its bark was wrinkled, its girth impressive. He stepped back for a better look, and then back further, trying to see the canopy, the crown. He muttered, "How tall are oak trees supposed to grow? 30, 40 meters? This baby is 100 meters at least." 112, came a soft voice. Jophiel turned. Flammarion Grant walked out of the shade, her footsteps soft on the sparse grass in the shade of the tree, her black and silver suit pristine. Where the sunlight caught her face, dappled through the oak's leaves, she looked beautiful, he thought. Beautiful, yet vacant. The marble beauty of a statue, hard and empty. She was smiling at him. Why then did his heart thump as she approached? Why did he feel an inclination to recoil, as if he was living through a scene from some half-forgotten nightmare? He looked away and glared up at the tree. "Too big," he muttered. "I'm sorry?" "The tree's too big. Oak trees don't grow that tall, or that fat." "This is Earth, right?" He jumped up and down. "I can feel the gravity." "The tree is what, 2, 3 times too tall?" She smiled, as if responding to a bright but confused child, Jophiel thought, irritated.
"Quite right," she said. "But this tree didn't grow on Earth. It is the Traverse Oak."
"From the Cydonia Dome, on Mars?"
"Correct. I, or my wet human template, grew up at Cydonia, my brother and me. And I always loved this tree, supposedly descended from trees grown from an acorn carried from Earth by one of the first human explorers of the planet."
"Can't have been," Jophiel muttered. "The interregnum before the recovery age recolonization of Mars was too long for any trees to have survived. Even an acorn couldn't have survived the Martian cold in some broken-down shelter." "Oh, but as implausible legends go, it isn't too outrageous, is it? And look at it. What a spectacle. Your friend Nicola Emery, with her fascination with mythology, might think it an avatar of Yggdrasil, the world tree of myth."
"What about consistency protocols?
A tree grown to 3 times its Earth-limited height has 27 times the bulk. The good old square cube law. It couldn't grow on Earth. This shouldn't be allowed."
"Oh, protocols, protocols. Where is your imagination, Jophiel? We are in a place where even the laws of nature are no more than advisory guidelines."
"Place? What place?"
"Well, this is officer country. And it is a country of a sort. It does help, oddly, to have something that doesn't fit, such as the tree, a continual visual reminder of our actual location, our purpose, our nature as the years tick by, the decades even."
"Decades?
Come now, Jophiel. You worked out the essence of it from my brother's careless remarks. A minute is a day. We teach that to the crew so they don't waste our time outside. Here, time runs 1,500 times as fast as in the rest of the ship, indeed the rest of the flotilla. For me and the rest of the officers, and for you now, a minute on the outside is indeed more than a day here on the inside. And a day outside is more than 4 years for us, inside. A human virtual running at 1,500 times life speed needs 1,500 times the processing power. Power you're effectively stealing from the mission and compromising the mission's objectives. He gestured at the tree. That's not accounting for the rest of it. The props in your made-up world like this tree. No wonder the energy budgets are so screwed up. Oh, we're stealing nothing. Nothing meaningful. We are still doing our essential job, you know. Gear is an instrument platform flying through the galaxy, almost like a primitive Anthropocene-era planetary flyby probe, or the outriggers first sent to the stars by your own ancestors, Jophiel. And what we found is remarkable, if irrelevant. Your discoveries are irrelevant how? Compared to all this. Out there is irrelevant compared to what we can build in here. Inside officer country, can't you see it? We don't need to discover. We don't need to go all the way to the core to take on the Chile. We can create. She knelt, supple, and picked up a fallen oak leaf, green and soft. Look at this. Look at the texture. You can examine it as closely as you like. Look deep enough, and you would see coils of DNA all perfectly simulated. Have you any idea how much processing power it takes to simulate a single leaf like this? Wincing, he took the leaf. I can guess. She held out a hand. Hold on to me now. Uncertainly, he took her hand. It was cold as marble, though flesh soft. What for? You often fall. Often. Another odd term, out of place. I don't get it. You will. The ground pushed up like a blister. Jophiel staggered back. Before him the ground bulged upward, as if driven by some huge force. The turf split and tore, soil spilling 20-30 meters from his feet. He saw it all, every detail, as if his own perception was accelerated, even more than it evidently had been already. And at the edge of the park, he could see buildings not remotely designed to stand such stresses burst open from within, their walls crumbling to showers of masonry, upper stories collapsing down on the lower in plumes of grey dust. Glass fragments seemed suspended in the air, sparkling in the sunshine, and when the masonry dust reached ground level, it began to flow outwards, billowing rivers of dust shaped by the pattern of streets, like an image from some hideous Anthropocene-era terror attack. All this was accompanied by a dull roaring noise. And something new rose from the destruction from under the ground. A black prow, night dark, smooth shoulders that flared into wings. It can't be. A profound, visceral fear clenched at Jophiel's gut. The Chile. Here. Flammarion gripped his hand. You first saw the Chile emerge from a wormhole mouth in orbit around Jupiter, didn't you? But it came not for Jupiter, but for Earth, for mankind. This is symbolic, but it is the essence of what you saw, what you caused. Stay strong. Stay calm. Don't faint. In fact, he did feel as if he might faint.
He was light-headed, the world greying around him. How could she know that? You often fall. As if she had watched him go through this experience before and knew his reactions before he displayed them. The Chili broke free of the ground with a shock, a shudder, just 100 meters or so from Jophiel, sending splinters of granite bedrock spinning through the air, a rising cloud. The Sycamore Seed ship itself soared into the sky, a black sun rising. And from it burst cherry red rays, 3 of them that cut through the innocent air. Around the horizon he heard explosions, saw rubble and ash rise. Smoke began to cover the sky. "This is how it feels, Jophiel Pool, in your deepest perception, in your conscience, a word you told me Nicola would use." Even now he was distracted by oddities in her speech. "When did I tell you about Nicola and words like conscience?"
"We must go. Be ready."
"For what?"
"Cold."
And the daylight folded neatly away. The sky was black. If there were stars, Jophiel's watering eyes could not make them out. And after a couple of heartbeats, the cold cut through his thin clothing, cut into him, and he wrapped his arms around his chest, shuddering deeply, his breath steaming. This was still the city scene, but now the surface of the park itself, swathes of dead grass, was lost under meters of water ice snow, frozen as hard as basalt. Away from the devastation of the Chile eruption, taller buildings still protruded from the ice, smashed, broken, mostly abandoned. The big, old carbon sequestration dome still stood, he saw. The city looked oddly beautiful. And it was not dead. Walkways had been cast over the banks of snow. Even now people went about their business, too far away for him to make out the detail. Flammarion was still here, bundled up now in bright orange Antarctic-ready gear, it seemed. With mittened hands, she threw a blanket over his shoulders. It helped a little, but the shivering was taking control. She murmured,
"We can't stay here long. Do you know where you are?"
"Earth. Cold Earth. Looks like the early days after the displacement, before the air started to snow out."
"And I did this?"
"Yes. You sent Earth to the Oort Cloud, out to the cold. Do you know how many people died?" He did know, in detail. "I did it to save Earth from the Chile. The planet buster cage. It had already wrecked Mars.
You caused a harm almost as grievous, though, didn't you? Do you think of that as you try to sleep at nights?"
"Why are you doing this?"
"To make you see that I'm right. We're right."
"Right about what? Retreating to some virtual fantasy land?" It occurred to him now that he need not endure any more of this. Nicola had given him a panic button. Oh, to Leith with it. He reached into his pocket, hand like a claw in the cold, to find nothing. Flammarion was smiling again.
"You're looking for your amulet. I'm afraid that's long gone. We took it away."
"How did you know?" She seemed unable to keep from bragging, from showing her command.
"Because you used it before, or tried to. We are observant, you know. And so are you. You're figuring it out, aren't you? Be ready. Here we go again."
"To where?"
"Close your eyes."
He obeyed. What else could he do? A lurch, as if he was falling. Not cold, at least. Not warm, either, though it was difficult to tell as his chilled body continued to shiver, and he clutched the blanket closer over his shoulders, trapping his body warmth.
silence. A profound silence that he knew, sensed, stretched to infinity, a silent world. Open your eyes now. It is very dark. Don't be alarmed. Let your vision adjust. He obeyed. The sky was almost black, somber. No stars, at least no sun, and none of the bright white diamonds that had graced the sky of Earth. Gradually he made out a kind of crimson river, a scatter across the sky. Still more gradually that river resolved into dull red pinpoints like glowing coals. Under his feet, soil. The ground of the park? If so, any grass was long dead, the soil hard, barren. Flammarion murmured, "Again, do you know where you are?" "More to the point is when we are, right?" "The very far future." He gestured. "That's the galaxy. Are we outside it? Nothing burning but red dwarfs, small, long-lived stars. The rest, stellar remnants. Black holes, neutron stars, right?" "The whole universe is like this, Jophiel. Cooling, dimming, decaying. Before yet another cosmos-wide convulsion rips it all apart. And what of human ambition then? If everything is to end in a burned-out heap, what is the point of all the great project of you pools? What's the point of all your plans, your building? What's the point of living?" "Eternity. You fear it, don't you? When you wake in those dark hours before dawn, when all of us must experience some kind of existential doubt, as if death, personal and for the species itself, becomes real in our minds without distraction, you don't have to say anything," she said gently. "I know you, Jophiel." But he was surprised to discover she was wrong. Definitely, for the first time. Yes, he had nightmares about unleashing the Chili on mankind. He had nightmares about cold Earth, who wouldn't? But not about this, about the triumph of entropy. And even if he did, eternity wasn't a word he would use. When discussing the far future, the Poole family archives had always referred to... No. He kept silent. He tried not even to think, to follow the chain of logic through, tried not to say the words even in the recesses of his own head, which was, after all, a virtual construct itself, and presumably open for inspection. "Can you not see?" Flammarion said now, sounding almost seductive. "It doesn't have to be like this. Not for us, not in here. That's why I'm showing you all this. We can defy entropy, escape death, or at least postpone it indefinitely. All we need is enough power for the processor arrays. Coffee." "What?" "Enough with the existential angst. Buy me a coffee. Let's sit down somewhere civilized and just talk." He slipped the blanket off his shoulders and handed it to her. "No more special effects." She nodded. "You're ready, at last." She snapped her fingers. Walls congealed around them. Chapter 6. Some kind of canteen. Crowded tables, wall dispensers, bots quietly serving. An atmosphere of non-specific calm, carefully synthesized. Suddenly he was sitting in a light chair facing Flammarion. He thought the gravity felt a tad less than Earth normal, and he thought he could feel a distant, very familiar thrum, the smooth working of a Poole Industries gut engine, maybe even one of his own designs. He was in space on some kind of gutship, a big one, perhaps one of the huge interplanetary freighters that had sailed between the worlds in the years before the Chili,
or even one of the upmarket passenger liners, and a mug of coffee steamed before him. Flammarion smiled.
Thanks. He sipped the coffee.
In a sense, I did have to buy you that, didn't I? In terms of the processing power it takes to simulate it.
At 1500 times external ship's rate.
Indeed. How is it?
Too much milk.
She laughed softly. I do like you, Jophiel. As I always liked your template.
Jophiel glanced around. A hum of discussion, but the other people were too far away to distinguish faces, to hear words pick out conversation threads. He imagined that was by design. It only added to the general sense of unreality of the scene.
Tell me how it started, he said gently.
She shrugged.
It was never planned. But we are all virtual, Sir Jophiel. All of us active crew on gear. And from the beginning, we often found it convenient to accelerate perception rates if a contingency demanded it. An emergency of some kind. It became habitual. It made life so much easier to run at a faster rate than the crew, faster than the unfolding of events in the outside universe. And once a few had migrated over, it was necessary for the rest to follow. It is essential to have colleagues working in the same frame, so to speak. It didn't take long for the basic parameters to be established. I mean 1500 to 1. It seemed convenient, an extreme compression, but not one that left our perceptual horizons so terribly disjointed from the crew's. Then there was the 40-day lifespan.
She eyed him.
Perhaps you can appreciate the cruelty of that. But if a few weeks can be spun out to a century, wouldn't you take the chance?
He estimated energy usages in his head. And the drain on the gut drive output that you were able to conceal for a long while. In fact, it might never have been noticed if you hadn't started to become greedy.
Greedy?
A harsh word. Her pleasant expression didn't waver.
But if one can be greedy for beauty, for richness, of experience, you saw that oak leaf, you touched it. Guilty as charged.
What about backups? She looked at him closely.
Now why do you ask that?
He warned himself he had to be careful, that she could erase him in an instant if she chose. Yet she had planted the seed of suspicion in his head, surely deliberately. In some way, he was supposed to figure this out.
You often fall.
It's in the basic design, in case of system failure. My system, or Michael's. I'm an engineer, just trying to understand your procedure. She relaxed, marginally.
Yes. We do restore from backups sometimes. If a virtual becomes corrupted somehow,
you can go back to a copy made in an earlier date, with an earlier state of its memory.
It's very rare.
She looked briefly troubled, and yet that brief concern might have been deliberately signalled, as if, he thought again, she was an actress playing a part. He wondered if he had gone beyond the script yet, and if so, how he could tell for sure. Because he was certain now. He had been through all this before. Both of them had, many times. And maybe it was like this in every read-through, so to speak. Every time some novelty, every time a difference to be ironed out, and every time he was restored from backup to an earlier state of consciousness and memory and run through the drama again. Now she leaned forward.
What is it you want, Jophiel?
I was sent here to try to understand what is going on within gear, starting with an explanation of the anomalous power usage. That's still my goal. And to achieve that goal, I'm trying to understand you.
She studied him coldly. "And how far has your understanding got?"
"Some distance."
"Maybe it's a consequence of enclosure. Here we are 400 light-years from Earth, surrounded by infinity, enclosed in these tiny boxes, the life domes. And yet you, the Gear officers, found the resources of a virtual universe to play with. You started to diverge from the crew. And once you grew impatient with ordering around those slow-motion automatons, that divergence was only ever going to grow. A natural route to a kind of totalitarianism, I guess. Unchallengeable. To the crew, you must be like capricious gods. I mean, your own brother.
Very insightful. But you don't yet understand it all."
"I dare say I don't. Did we get to this point before? The previous cycle, the backups?"
She smiled. "Finish your coffee. Then stand up."
He obeyed, and once again he was dropped out of one world into another. Chapter 7. A beach, this time. He was standing on very fine sand. An ocean lapped only a few paces away, languid and oily, stretching to a flat horizon. Flammarion stood beside him, watching his reaction. He looked around. Above him, a twilight sky speckled with pale stars laced with wispy clouds. There was silence save for the soft folding of the wavelets. No wind. The beach sloped up to a fringe of trees, squat, heavy, very dark green. He thought they were trees, but the forest was so dense it had the look of some vast, hulking animal, a single entity. And a shadow swept low over Jophiel, coming over the trees silent, making him duck reflexively. There was a wash of air and a thick animal scent. He looked up. The body of the thing that had flown by might have been human once. The torso and waist looked normal, but the legs seemed to have fused into one complex limb, like an extension of the spine, and the arms were stubs close to the body, from which bony extrusions stuck out, rib-like structures that held open wings, membranous sails attached to the residual legs by flaps of skin. All of this was spectral, pale in the muddled starlight. The wings rustled, the body twisted and banked, and when it flew out over the sea it soared up, perhaps riding thermals over the warmer water almost joyfully. Then the creature looked down. Jophiel saw a human face, stretched and distorted, the chin dissolving into the neck and huge black eyes. Flammarion smiled.
"Well?"
"At first, it reminded me of a butterfly. But it's more like a bat, or...
or a pterosaur?"
"Those wings are supported by much of old finger bones. Evolution here is more Lamarckian than Darwinian. What one wishes to become, one becomes."
"One?
Who was that?"
"You know him.
That's why I brought you here. His name is Tim Thomas."
"Timothy? From Mars?"
"You saved his life, or Michael did. His siblings serve aboard the Couchy, of course, Alice and Bob. He came here, applied to be an officer. He was one of the first to spin up. And he has gone much further than most of us have dared yet."
She smiled, rueful.
"You come here accusing me, at least implicitly, of a dereliction of duty, for not filing reports on engine malfunctions. Yet I have stayed loyal, stayed snagged in slow time. I could have had this."
"But what is this? What will you become?
A bunch of old machines growing older and older, their memories becoming more and more clogged. I've known elderly artificial sentences, elderly